I'm Wes Howard Brook. I've had a chance to meet some of you. I hope to meet all of you as the week goes by. It's truly my pleasure and honor to be back at Holden. It's been a decade since I was here doing this kind of stuff in this room, and it's always a wonderful opportunity. People who come to Holden are always open to new things and already come with lots of experience and ideas, so I hope this will be a conversation more than me just talking at you. So what I want to start by doing is just orienting today and the week, and then I'm going to ask you a question. The work we'll be doing in Genesis is grounded in the theme in my recent book here, Come Out My People, God's Call Out of Empire in the Bible and Beyond, available for your perusal or purchase in the bookstore. And I'm not going to get into the whole thing, but we're going to need to understand a little bit about what the point of the book was to see why we're going to work with Genesis the way we are today and the rest of this week. One of the challenges for anybody who claims to be a follower of Jesus and yet deals with the Bible as a whole in some category called the Word of God or inspired or something like that is to have to deal with the fact that Jesus says, among other things, love your enemies. And yet we know in the book of Joshua and other places, Yahweh says to destroy your enemies. So what about that? You know, it's a problem that people have dealt with from nearly the beginning of the occasion to collect the Hebrew Scriptures and these books that became the New Testament. One solution in the second century was to say the God of the Old Testament wasn't really God. You know, it was some imposter masquerading as God, and Jesus revealed who the real God was, this God of love and peace and harmony. Well, of course, the early church rejected that possibility. Another possibility that that came up, although I think it's frightening, its implications, is that God changed. God used to be a God of violence and vengeance, and then somewhere along the line shifted and became a God of love and peace. But if God changed once, what stopped God from changing again?
You met Jesus, right?
You're right.
Sorry, I can't help it.
Wait, jump right in there. Thank you. And in fact, as we'll look at on Friday, Abraham certainly believes he can convince God to be a little more gentle to the people of Sodom. So that's not a completely random way to look at it. So thank you for throwing that in there. I don't think that's a very useful response, not Doug's response, but the response that God changed, because it does really suggest that God's an unstable reality. And how do we know that God then isn't like Jupiter or Zeus, that's arbitrary and capricious and can, on a good day, be loving, and on a bad day, not? I hope that's not the case. And I believe it's not. Another way to resolve the question is just to duck. You know, just to kind of not look at it. And I think that's what most of us tend to do. It leaves us uncomfortable. We squirm a little bit at it. And yet it's hanging out there. One reason we have to deal with it, I believe, and that's why I worked on this book, was that throughout Western history, in the name of Christianity, emperors and kings and others have called upon the violent, vengeful, enemy-destroying God of the Old Testament to wipe out indigenous peoples or, more often, other Christians in the name of Jesus. So we can't avoid our history, and of course, because of that history, so many people in our secularized world look at something called Christianity and go, who wants to have anything to do with that? So that's what led to this book. So the first sentence of the book is one I'm just going to let hang there for a moment, what you think about. And it goes this way. There is not now, nor has there ever been, such a thing as Christianity or Judaism. And I think once you start to think about that, we'd probably all agree it's true. We use those words like they connote specific content. But who's Christianity? All we have to do is look around our world today and realize within the label Christianity can be so many things that it really stops meaning anything at all. And the same with Judaism. And in fact, it's always been true for the people of Israel that there's never been one such thing
that all of Israel, or later all Jews, believe. Jews and Israelites have never at least had the idea that there would at least be a hierarchical authority that would claim to articulate what we're all supposed to believe, like the Catholic Church has, for example, which has not been very effective, but at least in its attempt to say there's some authority that says this is what we believe. So I don't think those labels are helpful. In fact, I think they're distracting because we often use them without reflecting on the fact that they're not at all clear what they mean. But I do believe there are two religions in the Bible, two competing ways of binding individual people together as a people. And that requires me to pause just for a moment to invite us to reflect on the meaning of the word religion. Again, in our world, we often use that word without really thinking about what we mean. And so if we say religions, you think Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, things like that. But what's true for Judaism and Christianity is also true for Buddhism. It's also true for other things. And in naming those things that we tend to call the world religions, I think we ignore something very powerful and important, which is there are many, many other religions. The word religion from the Latin, religio, simply means to bind again. So I'd like to suggest for the purpose of our discussion today and this week, and just for your reflection, that we expand the meaning of the word religion to include whatever worldview and practices make people a people. So in that sense, nationalism is a very strong religion, often stronger than something called Christianity. Obviously, Hitler understood that well, and many people in our country understand that well. You wave flags, you pledge allegiance, you sing a song together, you rise and you sit. What we think of as religious acts in the name of country. There are also many religions that aren't as strong as that, but still have some function that way. Sports partisanship. Now, sports partisanship usually won't kill or die for. I suppose it depends upon how much you love your team. Here in Washington, you get Huskies and Cougars arguing with each other, and if you're not from Washington State, don't worry about that. But clearly, even though it's a religion in the sense that people feel bonded by that, they wear colors and clothes and do things that make them feel connected to other people because of that, it's what I would refer to as a weak religion. It doesn't purport to control all of your life, just a piece of your life. For many people, what we think of as Christianity is a weak religion. It competes with other religions in your life, like capitalism or nationalism or other things like that. So with that at least glimpse of a wider sense of what religion is, I'd like to suggest there are two major religions in the Bible. One I call the religion of creation, and one the religion of empire. And the wider argument of the book, which we won't get into this week, is that those two religions battled with each other for the authority of a God named Yahweh for 1,000 years. And the Bible contains texts from both sides. And Jesus comes along in the first century and claims that one of those, the religion of creation, expresses the way and reality of the one true God. And the religion of empire is a demonic counterfeit. And for that reason, the upholders of the religion of empire had him destroyed. So, to get a glimpse of that, let me show you something that's from the book, and I'll just invite us to just consider it for a moment, and then we'll get to Genesis. So here's a little chart of the two religions. At least it's found in the Hebrew Bible. And I hope that's big enough for you to be able to see it, trade-off between size and being able to see the whole thing. So on the left column here, you see some of the features that are in any kind of major religion. And then in the middle column is the religion of creation. The right column is the religion of empire. So, for example, the source of divine power for the religion of creation, and we'll explore this today in Genesis, is that there's one God who's the creator of heaven and earth. But in the religion of empire, there's usually many gods and goddesses. God's home in the religion of creation is beyond and within creation and among people. But in the religion of empire, it's virtually always in a temple that's near the palace in a royal city. And if you were to go through each one of these, you'd see how they're exactly opposite. Other examples have to do with, and we'll explore some of these later in the week, with the response to social space. So, not surprisingly, in the religion of creation, all of creation is sacred. All of creation can bear God's presence. In the religion of empire, the city is sacred. And outside the city is chaos, not the divine presence. The religion of creation sees human beings and all creation as part of one family. Cross species, including the stars and the planets and the creatures below the earth. If any of you are here next week when we look at the book of Revelation, we'll see that in the celebration in Revelation 5, that all creatures above and below, on the earth and below the earth, join the celebration of the Creator. Whereas in the religion of empire, there's always an us and them. There's always the insiders and the outsiders. And outsiders are treated with suspicion and, if necessary, violence. And finally, one that's so important for us, I think, in our world, is the economic contrast. In the religion of empire, as we know, economics is grounded in debt and money. And we're so used to money that it's hard for us to even recognize that in the scheme of human history, it's a relatively recent thing. In Jesus' time, it was one option. It wasn't required. One of the stories often misinterpreted that we won't look at in this session is when Jesus is tested around the question of a coin with Caesar's picture on it. And the often missed key to that story is Jesus doesn't have one. He asked them to provide a coin. He doesn't have one. Because you didn't have to have coins. Because in the religion of creation, economics is about gift, and not about money and debt. Okay? So that's just the big picture of that. And it plays out throughout the entire Bible. Just to illustrate briefly where the New Testament plays out on that. So here's just a few examples of the same themes in the left column. You know, what Jesus claims, what the supporters of empire claim, and how Jesus responds to empire's claims. And again, I don't expect you to look at this in detail now, but just to give you the big picture. Around each point, Jesus sides clearly with what we're calling the religion of creation. His opponents respond with the defense of what we're calling the religion of empire, and then he challenges them on it. Just one thing after another. Okay. So from that perspective, the book of Genesis, I hope you'll see, rings with a different tone. So before we get there, I want to ask you the question that I suggested at the beginning. So as we come in, what are your presuppositions about what the book of Genesis is, why it was written, what questions it was designed to address? Just a few thoughts from you. What's the book of Genesis about? What's it for? Let me just get the ball rolling by saying, I assume that people at Holden Village don't think it was written to deal with the question of how old the earth is. And we laugh, and there is a humor in that, but obviously an awful lot of people do think it's about that, and that's part of what makes the book of Genesis look so ridiculous to so many people, wrongly understood.
Just basic, I think, would be, where did we come from and how did we get here?
Where did we come from? How did we get here? Great question.
Where did the Jews come from? Where did a particular people come from?
Where did the Jews come from? And of course, Warren already laid out his cards. I won't make you say it right now. With another assumption based on the last couple centuries of scholarship. If you want to add that at one point, feel free. Others. Everybody can play. You've all heard of the book of Genesis, right? Yeah.
Well, you know, it seems like every society has a name for itself. You know, the people, our people, us. And if you look at the Indians, they have their creation story about them. And you look at you mentioned the Mesopotamians have their own creation story about them. So, to me, this is the story of the people that wrote it about them.
Okay, great. So it's a story of the people that wrote it about them. One Israeli Jewish scholar who was criticized... who was responding to a criticism that the Hebrew scripture was so ethnocentric because it was focused on the history of Israel. And he said, of course it's ethnocentric. It's our story. If you wrote American history, it would be about America. Like, that's the idea, right? So, exactly that. Every people has some story about who we are and how we got here and how we relate to other people. But can I ask you a follow-up question? When might you imagine it was written? What might be the context out of which the Israelites decided we need to tell this written story about who we are and where we came from?
Written or told? Written or told?
Go ahead and fill out the distinction if you want.
Well, I think it was probably told many times around a campfire.
Okay.
Before it was ever written.
How long ago around a campfire?
Well, I think it probably evolved.
Fair enough. Do you want to give it some kind of dating realm?
Well,
a million years ago, 10,000 years ago?
You know, this group of people came, they're aligned. It came from somewhere. It probably was told, and evolved. To, before there was even Abraham, it was probably some sort of story that, you know, they told and developed eventually into this. I think that this is sort of like the evolution of species.
Okay. But you're not going to pin it down to a particular date.
No.
Fair enough.
No.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, I think it was probably written in response to outside forces, the forces of other competing groups in the world at that time.
Okay, and that's the premise that I'm going to work with in a moment. And it doesn't have to be the answer, but I'll provide just a little bit of evidence. The book provides more for why I think that's the case.
In contrast to the, it was inspired by God and Moses wrote it at once, I think that some progressive thinkers would say, oh, it must have been told over thousands of years, but that story says it was told the exact same way by every single person for those thousands of years, and it doesn't allow much variation to it. It doesn't account for what happens to the variation in the story.
Yeah. Which does lead to your premise, Warren, which I don't want to put you on the spot, but since you mentioned it and you were the first one in the room, you want to just name it because I'm sure you're not the only one who was taught this.
Well, the theory is that from whatever sources, they may have been documents or stories, during the Babylonian captivity, some of the scribes thought that we need to write this down, and let's take from various sources and write our story. Okay. And German scholars hundreds of years ago happened to notice is the name of God was different in different sections of Genesis. And there were other textual differences, and so they separated out these different parts. There was when God was referred to as Yahweh, I guess that was the J version, and when he was referred to as Elohim, that was the E version. And they just basically, with scissors and paste, one master editor put together the book of Genesis.
Okay. So thank you. So for those not familiar, but I'm sure many of you are, what Warren's summarizing very succinctly there is what's been traditionally known for the last 100 and something years as the four source theory, again grounded in German scholarship, and based on a premise which nobody had ever apparently noticed in the many hundreds if not thousands of years that Genesis had been a written text, that there seemed to be these different strands of writing in it that now were suddenly noticed by German scholars and could be separated out, but that somebody put together, but not well enough that you couldn't notice the differences. I'd like to suggest, that without getting into all of it now, and if anything I'm suggesting piques your interest, feel free to find me any other time outside our hour in the morning to talk about it, because I know I'm suggesting all kinds of things for further conversations that we can't talk about right now. But many scholars in recent years have begun to challenge what had been deemed almost a fact about the source theory. So many study Bibles, Catholic and Protestant, have footnotes that say, as if it's such a fact, this is a P text, meaning priestly from a particular strand, or a J text, as Warren was saying. And if you don't know otherwise, it seems like, well, it must be so, because it says so in my Bible, right there in the footnote. But many people are beginning to challenge that. And one of the things that's emerging is precisely because the scholars were German in that time period, that there was a certain amount, and maybe more than a certain amount, of at least implicit anti-Semitism in how Germans were reading the Hebrew Bible. That these Jewish writers weren't as smart as we German scholars are, and we figured out what they were doing. They left traces behind, and we can uncover it, because basically we're smarter than them. And partly that's a German anti-Semitism that goes back a long ways, and we know the consequences of that. Partly it's a function of a bigger, what scholars would call meta-narrative, a bigger story of the path of civilization, which moves from primitive to civilized as, quote-unquote, progress. Often that's got its own four stages, from hunter-gatherers to nomads, to simple agricultural people, to urban agricultural civilization. And so German scholars in the 18th and 19th century, looking back on the quote-unquote primitive Israelites, or even more so primitive Jews, saw them as writing out of this ancient context that now we Germans and moderns in general are advanced and superior to. Well, not only is, of course, the premises of German anti-Semitism been challenged in depth because, obviously, of the Holocaust, but so have the premises of that meta-narrative of Western progress. And that's something that Genesis challenges greatly. So I know you may have other presuppositions we didn't have time to look at now, but for the sake of making a little progress, I just want to offer here again for you to consider for a moment, and I know that I have to trade off size and visibility here. Here's just some of many possibilities for how to situate the book of Genesis, not only as a freestanding thing, but as the first book in this thing we know as the Bible. So here's just a range of things. So whether we think of it as the first book of the Catholic or Christian Bible, or something called the Old Testament, there's something at issue in calling it the Old Testament, versus the Hebrew Scripture, versus the Pentateuch. Each of those terms carries meaning and implications, or Torah, or some of these versions, which is what some of you have said, collections of stories explaining and interpreting events, or in the more literal, traditional sense, the first of five books, you know, given by God through Moses. In later understandings, a narrative fabric stitched together is what Warren was suggesting. As others are suggesting, perhaps folk tales about how things got to be. But what I'm going to be working with is this bottom one. A counter story to Babylon's Enuma Elish, written during or after the exile. And each day this week, we'll look at examples of how the Genesis narrative fits very well the context of that time period of the exile and of the story and counter-story relationship between the Babylonian creation story. So what that implies in terms of biblical composition is this in the big picture. And I know because of the green and the red, you can't read that very well, but so let me just note that at the top here in the red, it says religion of empire, and it just has some elements of what the religion of empire is. And the green is religion of creation. And so what I've tried to do is map out parts of the Bible and non-biblical texts in relation to how close they are to the religion of creation, how close they are to the religion of empire across time. So one of the things that we won't work with today or this week, but it's in part two of the book, is what might be surprising to many people, as I'm suggesting the first written text in the biblical canon is the David and Solomon succession story. That's the earliest written text, on the premise that writing began with empire. Ordinary people didn't have writing. Empires invented writing to preserve their version of things. That's what writing was for. And so there are lots of reasons why the David-Solomon story is a very suspicious story. Just to plant one seed, why would Solomon be David's successor? He's not the firstborn. How come he got to be the one? There's a lot of questions about Solomon. And one of the interesting things about Solomon, if you look at him in the context of the canon, is he's got a perfect match in another part of the Bible. He looks exactly like Egypt's pharaoh. So one of the things I work with in the book is that the Exodus story was written not to describe an actual historical event of Israelites migrating from Egypt, but as a metaphorical counter story to the David and Solomon story. And we won't get to work with that this week. And that the monarchy story develops across time, and so do counter stories from the religion of creation, many of which probably were oral and non-written, but were the ordinary things that people believed who just didn't buy into what the elite were saying.
This is so often the case. You know, presidents and popes and whoever can say what they want, and ordinary people on the ground believe what they believe. Maybe by consciously rejecting it, or maybe it just hasn't penetrated, or maybe just their traditions have been different, and that's what they believe. And so we don't have those written down, but some of them are implicitly criticized from the elite urban perspective in the Bible. And of course, the prophets through that time period. And then as you can see, at this far end of the first half of the timeline, the second half is below, comes the book of Genesis. And it's roughly simultaneous with books like Ezekiel and what we call 2nd Isaiah, the parts of Isaiah that are from chapter 40 to 55, and then also some other parts of what we now have as the Pentateuch, Numbers and Leviticus. And then what we're not going to do this week, but just so you can see the big picture of where the book goes, in the post-exilic period in the Second Temple, this same battle continues, first through the imperially sponsored rebuilding project narrated in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, where the Persian Empire invites the exiles to return and build a temple, which is as much of Persian interest as it is anybody else's. And then that continues through a period of establishment wisdom, elite wisdom, which is largely about maintaining the status quo, but then is responded to by the emergence of what we call the apocalyptic tradition. A tradition that claims that people can have direct experiences of the Creator God who reveals it a different way than what's being proclaimed by the elite. And much of that tradition was collected in one book that we now have as the title First Enoch. But then other apocalyptic texts come along as well. And of course the New Testament, which those of you here next week will look at, is itself deeply apocalyptic. From the beginning of Jesus' experience, when in Mark's Gospel he goes down to the River Jordan and the heavens were torn apart and the Spirit comes down like a dove and there's a voice that says, "You are my beloved Son and you I am well pleased." That's a classic apocalyptic experience. And of course, so is Paul's on the road to Damascus. And in fact, Paul writes in his letters, I didn't get this from human beings, but from an apocalypsis, a revelation of Jesus Christ. So the New Testament is taking up the apocalyptic tradition and rejecting most of this Second Temple imperial wisdom. For example, Ezra and Nehemiah are never quoted or mentioned in the New Testament. And most Christians aren't very familiar with them. I encourage you to read them if you're not, because they're very powerful expressions of how an urban elite can commandeer a tradition for its own purposes, something we experience all too often in our society. Okay, so that's the big picture. I know that's a lot of big picture before we actually begin to look at the book of Genesis, but just questions or observations on that if you're confused.
The vertical relationship of the different books, was that showing a spectrum?
Yeah, it is a spectrum. There are some texts that are more clearly at one end of the spectrum than the other. There are others that are attempting to be somewhere in the middle. So, for example, some of the post-exilic texts accept the premise that there's going to be a Jerusalem, and there's going to be a temple, and that that's the important place. But they claim, for example, that everybody's welcome there. So those are some of the texts like from 3rd Isaiah that we hear brought into the New Testament, except Jesus rejects the temple. So it's like, everybody's welcome to be part of God's people, but the place they gather around is me, not the building. And of course, one of the facts is the texts we have are all written by the elite. The texts that would be preserved across history are those by the literate few whose words would be remembered. So we don't have in writing what ordinary people or people who are just so far outside the establishment that their word nobody would have kept their words thought. We can only infer it in places. Okay? So that leads us to Genesis. And that leads us back to Babylon and Enuma Elish. The Enuma Elish is an amazing story, and in this modern world, maybe not in Holden, but when you get home, you can Google it and it'll come right back up. And so you can read it in translation very easily, and it's, I would encourage you to if you never have. It's an amazing story. I won't tell the whole thing, but a few elements of it that are important to hear so we can hear how Genesis echoes against it. In the beginning, Enuma Elish says, there were two gods, a male god and a female god. And the male god is the sky, and the female god is the ocean.
And they made it, and they had children, and the children made a lot of noise, and they couldn't sleep. Maybe her parents understand the feeling. And so in their sleeplessness, they decide they should kill their children. And the children get wind of it, and so they plan a counterattack, and they kill Dad. And Mom is very upset at that, of course. And Mom finds another husband, and they decide, what are we going to do now? And while they're plotting to take on their children, the children decide that Mom has to go. Mom is named Tiamat. And so the children gods ask themselves, which one of us are willing to go battle Mom? Anybody who's a psychologist in the group can have a field day here with the Freudian implications, huh? And the god who volunteers is named Marduk. And Marduk says, what do I get if I defeat Mom? And they say, what do you want? He says, I want to be king and have a royal city. And so Marduk takes on Tiamat, and in the powerful and graphic image of the Enuma Elish, it says, he blew into her until she swelled up and then exploded, and he burst her body open like a clamshell, and out of that dead body of mother came forth all the creatures of the earth. Not yet people. And so Marduk has his royal city. Guess what city it was? Babylon. And then he gets to be king over the other gods. But the gods discover quickly that a city requires a lot of work that's beneath the dignity of gods. So they need to come up with some being that will do all the dirty work, like grow food and provide sanitation and do all those things. And that's what people are for. So human beings in Enuma Elish are created to do the grunt urban work that serves the gods. In other words, they're an afterthought. The city comes first, and people come later. So for people in the historical city of Babylon, some of the implications of this are that the city itself was made by the gods. It's not a human building project. It's eternal. Its social order is as basic as we think of as the laws of nature. Try to argue with gravity and see where it gets you. So you can't argue with the divine order. You can rebel against it, but that's to your own misfortune or death. It just is what it is. And of course, what it means is the people who inhabit the royal offices in the city of Babylon are in the place of the gods. So when you serve the king, you're serving Marduk. Okay? When the Babylonians defeated Jerusalem and destroyed the temple and brought the elite of Judah and Jerusalem to Babylon, that was the story that was told. And of course, to go to Babylon was not like going into some terrible place. Compared to Jerusalem, Babylon was a spectacularly beautiful, what we might call modern city. You know, full of art and architecture and science and all kinds of things. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon were one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, and they knew geometry, and, you know, they knew all kinds of stuff that the Israelites probably didn't even know at all. And Jerusalem was a relatively small place, so going to Babylon was not like a terrible punishment, other than the fact that if you believe that Yahweh was God and Marduk didn't exist, this story and this social order was completely contrary to what you believed. Now, we can't answer the question that is a good one of how long was Genesis told and in what forms is it told orally. Oral tradition leaves no traces. That's one of the things about it. But the written version of Genesis we have fits perfectly as a counterstory to Enuma Elish. So what I'd like to do in just the little bit of time we have left today is look briefly at how that happens in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, and that'll set the stage what we do the rest of the week. So, as we noted, in Enuma Elish, creation happens through this violent battle between the gods. But in Genesis 1, how does creation take place? What does Yahweh do to make things happen?
Speaks.
How different is that? Yahweh said, and there was.
And, you know, there's a lot we could do looking at Genesis 1, and we're not going to look at all the details here. One of the elements of it that, of course, I'm sure we all recognize, is there's a rhythm and a pattern to it. And it echoes with the refrain each time, and there was evening, God saw that it was good, and there was evening, and there was morning, the second day, the third day, etc. So a couple things about that. It's all good. You know, we sometimes use that phrase in our culture when it's not true. Well, it's all good. Well, not everything's good. And sometimes we use it as a cop-out for not dealing with the things that aren't good. But in God's creation, according to Genesis 1, it is all good. You know, we sometimes inherit, and especially I know for Lutherans, the tradition of Augustine and such, that raises questions about the state of human nature and whether it's good or not, as we inherited it. Genesis knows nothing about something called original sin. And we'll talk a little more about that tomorrow, when in the garden story, there's no mention of sin at all. But certainly in Genesis 1, the way God creates everything is good. Stars, the earth, the plants, the animals, and then eventually people. And of course, people in Genesis 1 here created not as an afterthought, but as the culmination of creation. And the culmination aspect is emphasized a couple of ways by God's noting that the things created on the sixth day are not just good, but very good. And of course, it's the end and the completion of God's act of creation. So, you know, we in our modern sense of biological evolution, you know, might note that it's curious, if not more, that the order of creation in Genesis actually does fit what we would understand about the order of biological development. You know, first non-seed-bearing plants, and then seed-bearing plants, and then creatures from the sea, and then creatures from the land, and then human beings. How did they know that? You know, it's not at all obvious, is it? Like, you wouldn't just look out at the earth and guess that that was the sequence, would you? I wouldn't. Maybe you're more insightful about that than I am. You know, I look out at the mountains here and wonder how they figured out there was copper in the rocks, but that's another story. So it's all good. And then there's human beings made in the image and likeness of God. Now, that begs 100 questions. What does that mean? What about human beings are like the image of God? And there's not an answer to that. But it's certainly very different than Enuma Elish. It's not that humans are some afterthought designed to do city dirty work. It's that humans are made, unlike the rest of the creatures, which are all good, like God. Male and female as a full expression. And again, in Enuma Elish, like so often, the religion of empire is not always, but usually patriarchal. Usually male-dominating and both in terms of gender, male men over women, but also men as the rulers over all people. But in Genesis 1, male and female are created absolutely equally. Which for an audience in the 6th century BCE would have been a startling claim. That male and female are equally expressive of the image of God. And then one more thing that we often miss, and then I'll jump very quickly to Genesis 2, is what God says there in verse 29. And there are questions about verse 28, but we'll come. If you'll stay with me during the week, we'll come back to that a little bit on Wednesday about the question of subdue it and have dominion. For now, I'd just like to note, God said, "See, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit, you shall have them for food." Which to say we were made to be vegetarians. I'm not making this up, you know. But there's more to it than that. It's not just about being vegetarians. It's about eating the food that God provides. I have given every green plant for food. Every plant yielding seed and every tree with seed in its fruit, you shall have them for food. According to Genesis,
humans were made to be vegetarian foragers. There's nothing here about a city. There's nothing here about the later development we call civilization. This is complete. You know, in verse 1 of chapter 2, thus the heavens and the earth were finished, or the word could be translated completed. This is not like part one, and then creation is supposed to pick up somewhere later, or I've done this, and now your job is to finish it by making cities and empires and all this stuff. It's completed. What's left to do is to enjoy it. You know, one thing we often miss about the hallowing of the seventh day here is we're so used to the later idea in terms of biblical chronology. Earlier in terms of writing, but later in terms of chronology, the Exodus commandment version, which makes the Sabbath one day of rest and a cycle of 7 days. But in Genesis 1, it's supposed to be Sabbath from then on. You know, it's not that God rested then picked it up again on Monday. It's Sabbath now. But the original design, according to Genesis, is that God did the work and our job is to just live in it. It almost seems too good to be true, doesn't it? And so much of what the rest of the Bible is about, and I think most of the work of our Christian discipleship is about, is getting all the stuff we've done to mess it up out of the way so we can receive it as the gift it was in the first place and still is, if we just recognize it. And of course, I'm sure that's what leads most of us to come, for at least for a time, to places like Holden. Okay. So then it continues. And many of us perhaps were taught, as a result of German scholarship and as it's passed on, that, well, Genesis has two creation stories, the creation story in Genesis 1, a different one in Genesis 2. And some Bibles even, quote-unquote, helpfully note that by having a bold heading that says second creation story. But is it a second creation story? Or is it the question of a cosmic perspective on creation and a from-the-ground perspective on the same creation? I'd suggest the author of Matthew's Gospel certainly understood it that way, because that's how he tells the story of the coming to be of Jesus. First, with a genealogy, and then with a close-up. And I would note here in the New Revised Standard, it says, not very helpfully, an account of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, son of David, son of Abraham. But the literal Hebrew would be translated as the book of the Genesis of Jesus the Messiah. The genealogy, once you start to think about it, is very closely related to the word Genesis, which is a Greek word. So the Hebrew Bible doesn't say Genesis. Ironically, all the words we have for the names of the five books of the Hebrew Bible are from the Greek, not from the Hebrew. The Hebrew word for the book of Genesis is Bereshit, which is the first word of the book, meaning beginning, in the beginning. But Matthew understands it in Greek, as all the evangelists do, and so Genesis echoing right from the beginning of all the Gospels, John's Gospel, in the beginning, you know, was the Word, etc., I'm talking about creation. So the book of the Genesis of Jesus the Messiah, and matching Genesis 1 and 2 exactly, it gives a genealogy, and now it has a close-up. Now the birth of Jesus the Messiah took place in this way. And nobody, I don't think, reads Matthew's Gospel as if, oh well, one person wrote verses 1 to 17 and somebody else came along and wrote the rest of it. Matthew read Genesis and used that as the template, I'd suggest, for the beginning of Jesus. You know, so there do not need to be two creation stories here. We can certainly read that as an aerial view, a cosmic view, the view from the perspective of the transcendent God who was and is apart from creation, and then the God who's present right within creation. And one thing that the four source theory suggests is that those were different perspectives from different people. One group of people had the idea that God was transcendent, and one group of people had the idea that God, in the technical term, was immanent or intimately present. But I don't think that makes any sense out of anybody's experience of the sacred, unless you start with that presupposition. Isn't there a sense in our own experience that God is both Emmanuel,
both here and present in me and you among us right now, and also far beyond and above, like Isaiah says, my ways are not your ways, my ways are far above your ways, and the heavens are above the earth. That those are both true, always, aren't they? That to have only one of those views is radically incomplete. Now, of course, there have been pantheists and there have been deists, and those are the two alternatives in the later understanding. You know, the deist with the God who got things moving and then is kind of watching from a distance, and the pantheist where God is nothing but the presence in creation, the force, in Star Wars terms, you know. But I don't think the Israelites were that naive. I think they understood that there was a both and to it. So I'd suggest at least that this garden story is a story of a close-up view of what is presented otherwise cosmically. If you saw it in a movie, you'd see the camera with, you know, the earth floating out there, and then the camera would zoom in and come up to this place. And again, translations sometimes distract us from things that are very important here. And so in the New Revised Standard, we have in the beginning of this close-up, in the day that Yahweh God or the Lord God had made the earth and the heavens, when no plant of the field was yet in the earth and no herb of the field had yet sprung up. And the Hebrew words at issue there, both in the sense of the prepositional phrase of the field repeated twice, but also the noun plant and herb refers to agriculture. Very specifically. What's at issue here, and you can hear it in the sense of the field. It doesn't say there's no plants on the ground. There's no plants in the field. So in other words, this story is taking place before there was such a thing as agriculture. And another translation issue, which unfortunately is misleading for people, at the end of the verse 5, there was no one to till the ground. The Hebrew ebed there most literally means to serve. To serve, in this case, the adama, the ground. One of the things that's so beautiful in Genesis is wordplay and what that reveals about the relationship. So one aspect of that here is how the Adam and the Adama and the Dam are all interconnected. So what exists at the beginning here is not somebody, a male person called Adam, awaiting later a woman called Eve, but an earthling from the earth, or if you will, a human from the humus, and Adam from the Adama. And the Adam, in terms of grammar, is male, but it's male in relation to the Adama, which is female. So the first orientation of is of an earth creature that's oriented vertically between itself and the ground, the topsoil. And then later in the story, there's the question of blood, which in English, none of these things connect. You can connect earth and earthling, human and humus, but then blood is different. Hebrew blood is dam, so the dam flows through the adam, and it's like liquid adama, which is, after all, what it is, isn't it? Blood, liquid topsoil, basically. I mean, our food grows through the topsoil, and we eat it, and if you mix it with water, that's blood, isn't it? So if you think of blood as liquid topsoil, it shows how, in a phrase I offer in honor of my wife Sue's pointing here, humans are inspired earth. Our earth with God's Spirit flowing through us. But it's not good to be in that state alone. Humans were not designed to be oriented solely to the topsoil, but to be oriented toward each other. And at this point, there's only one. So after this description of the situation, and the Adam, see, this says the man, and that ruins all that. It says, it is not good that the Adam should be alone. I will make him an Ezer Kenegdo, helper and partner. Translations are, you know, terrible there. King James said helpmate, and of course that reinforces patriarchy and all that stuff. The literal sense would be a counterpart. And in fact, some of the early rabbinical commentaries suggested, you know, with a certain whimsy, that the Adam was two creatures back to back. And what God then did was take off the half and turn it around and face this way. Like, that's a better idea, isn't it? Than having it back to back. Ah, yeah, now I've got a counterpart. Someone I can see and be seen by. And so that's what happens here, is this rib is taken, and then in verse 23, we hear. Then the Adam said, "This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. This one shall be called Isha, for out of Ish this one was taken." So it goes from orientation of Adam and Adama to Ish and Isha. Or in English it works man and woman when we think of it that way. And of course, they're both naked and unashamed and one flesh. How different that is from the Babylonian story, where men are dominant and men and women together, you know, do this slave labor to serve the city. We could get into a lot more details, but I just wanted, since we only have about 10 minutes left, just questions or comments from you. And we've covered a lot of ground here just in an opening session. But if there's things that have emerged that you have questions about or observations, I want to just give you a chance to share some. It's also clear that there's nothing to say. Or
is there something significant about Adam and animals and then the partner?
Yeah, that you know, the animals are not the counterpart for humans. It doesn't say they're bad, of course. And when we look tomorrow at the story of the serpent in chapter 3, Genesis has no sense of the serpent being the devil.
But I mean the sequence of it.
Yeah. What are you thinking? Go ahead and expand if
well,
you want.
That's I'm asking, what is your take?
Here in verse 20,
yeah.
That or in 19 and 20, that, yeah. That formed every animal of the field and bird of the air and brought them to the Adam to see what he would call them, and whatever he called them was its name, and gave names to all the cattle, to the birds of the air, and every animal of the field.
And then?
And then there was not found.
And then comes the woman.
And then comes, yeah, then comes this separation. Mm-hmm. Then actually, more literally, then comes man and woman for the first time. Goes from an earthling to man and woman. I don't know specifically in these verses of whether there's any difference between the sequence there of cattle, birds, and animals of the field in contrast to Genesis 1's sequence of development.
Would it make a difference if it said the animals, like an evolutionary biologist would, you know, have more acceptance of the animals coming before man?
Well, but it doesn't note here that this is the order in which they were created. It doesn't really say that their sequence. In the Hebrew, in verse 19, it's, and it is even in English, it's a conjunction. So it doesn't necessarily say, you know, if I pick three people in a row here and name you, it's not necessarily order of importance or creation. It's just a way of conjoining three things in a row. Genesis 1 clearly is a sequence. Here it's just a conjunction. And I can't give you a particular reason of why the conjunction is arranged in that sequence.
If God was independent of all these things, and God created man in his image, when he did that, man couldn't recreate himself, so they had to have something to recreate himself with, because he wasn't truly God.
Okay, so God created man and woman in God's
image. So they could have the ability to recreate it, to be the Lord.
There's a lot of possibilities in that little sequence there, huh? Because what we don't see in Genesis 2 any sense that the Adam or the Ish and the Isha are unsatisfied, that they're longing for something else. What they're longing for was an Ezer Kenegdo, a partner. And now, at verse 23, at last, now there is a partner, and like it's complete, just like the Genesis 1 story was complete in their Sabbath. So we later, and tomorrow, we'll look at Genesis 3, where something creeps into the picture and, you know, messes up this otherwise perfect situation. But at this point, there's nothing about creating new ones, you know. And I just want to note, just parenthetically, the Ish and the Isha are not anything we'd call married. This is not a story about marriage. It just says they're one flesh. As Ish and Isha, that's good enough for this audience. Which is the point saying it's not dealing with that question. When we try to make Genesis deal with questions it wasn't written to deal with, we get all kinds of garbage out. Like, is it, you know, was 6 days literally 6 days, and how old is the earth, and is this about marriage? Those are just not the questions that it's dealing with.
And the man given the responsibility for naming all the other creatures.
The Adam, anyway.
Taken.
It takes a while to get over that, doesn't it?
Taken to mean that this gave him dominion over them.
Yeah. And that's why I wanted to save the element from the earlier part in Genesis 1 about what that means to give God, to give human beings collectively dominion over creation. Because obviously that's been used as an excuse to say humans can do whatever we want with the earth and treat it all as natural resources and all that kind of stuff. And there's a whole dominionist theology around it's all just put there for us. But that's what Genesis 1 says. It's all good before there were humans. So we'll have to look at that, but we will look at that a little later in the week.
Would you expand a little bit on the difference between when it says the wild, more crafty than other wild animal, and then up there where it says cattle, and then birds of the air, and every animal in the field, and there's that field word again.
Yeah.
So God made things for human beings that were domesticated, for their domestic use in comparison with those that are wild.
Yeah, and that's certainly the case that Genesis presents there being what we generically call cattle, for them mostly sheep and goats, as in relationship with humans to allow humans to be able to survive while staying in motion. And when we get, let's see, on Thursday to the call of Abram, we'll see that Abram clearly takes as a given from what God offers that he's got cattle, quote unquote, to take with him along the way.
Yeah.
The question of domestication is one that many folks reading Genesis have asked more deeply now about. Is there a difference, and you're pointing this, I think, between domesticating animals and domesticating plants? One of the, at least the implications, is in domesticating animals like this, you can stay on the move. But when you domesticate plants, you're fixed to a place. And once you're fixed to a place, there are lots of implications of that that are not necessarily what God had in mind. We'll see.
I noticed something, and I wonder if I'm bringing it to the text or whether it's there and you can comment on it. In Genesis, I noticed that the plural is used for God when God created
Elohim,
man and woman. And then after the plants are given for humans to eat, it's mentioned what the beasts are given. So it's kind of like...
It's what?
It's mentioned what the beasts are given, what the beasts are given food to eat. So kind of like, I'm giving you something, I'm giving the animals something, so there's this plurality in God, this plurality in humans, and then plurality between humans and beasts. And I'm picking it up in chapter 2, too, with at least the plurality within humans and the plurality between humans. And
and you're naming something very important that Christians tend to either want to be uncomfortable with or to answer with some kind of Trinitarian assumption. Who's the divine we referred to? And we'll look at that more later in the week when we look at the Tower of Babel story. But also tomorrow in chapter 3 when it says they'll, you know, if we leave them alone, they'll eat from this and become like us. There's clearly an us. The text does not say who the us is, and it's perilous to try to answer, fill in the blank that the text leaves open. It's certainly not a later Christian trinity. Obviously, the authors of Genesis know nothing about that, although many Bibles make it sound like that's what it's about. And so I don't want to suggest I have an answer to something the text leaves open. But one thing that is clear, in contrast, say, with the Babylonian story, is in the Babylonian story, the divine plurality is a contentious one. That the mother and father god were at odds with the children gods, and the children gods pick a king to rule the other gods. Whereas the divine plurality in Genesis is of one voice. There's not different voices saying different things. They don't have to have a discussion and argue about what to do. So there's a unity of voice, even if there's a plurality of number that's unexplained there. But you're onto something really important, and it's probably the case that it's in exile that the Israelites first developed the concept of monotheism at all. That before that, Israelites were almost certainly not monotheistic. They were what scholars would call henotheistic, which is what we hear in the Ten Commandments. You shall have no other god before you. if there's only one God, you don't have to tell people to have no other gods before you. Mm-hmm. You can just say there are no other gods. They're henotheistic, like most of us are, you know, married to one person. You know, you choose to be in relationship with one God, and that God would be Yahweh. It's in exile they reflect on the fact that, you know, if Yahweh is not, if one of the options of the exile, and I know about out of time here, so I don't want to open too much of a big topic, but one of the options of theological interpretations of the exile is Marduk whoop Yahweh. So we should become Babylonians now. Right? That's what conquered people have often done throughout Western history. That's one reason they were open to Christianity, is obviously the gods of these people are stronger than our gods, because they just whooped us. I mean, smallpox, my God, where'd they get that from? You know, let alone guns and things. So obviously our gods are powerless in the face of their gods, so we should be worshiping the gods that are more powerful. So why tell us about your gods and we'll worship them? We only have one God. Okay, so I guess we'll be Christian. You know, but that was not the choice of the authors of Genesis. Their choice was, no, Yahweh was not defeated by Marduk. In fact, there is no Marduk. There only is one God. And that God rules not only over this area, Jerusalem, but over all of creation. But there are challenges of what monotheism is. Gender is one of them. And the location of God is another. So is the earth still sacred? If you reject the idea there's an earth mother and a sky father, whose union creates fertility and life, then what about the earth? And that's what can lead to the earth as just this inanimate thing that you can do whatever you want with. If God's primarily up there, and the earth is somehow some distance. So anyway, it's 10 o'clock. So thank you for participating openly and asking questions. Feel free to find me anytime along the day. Tomorrow we'll do chapter 3 and 4 and begin to explore what went wrong with this beautiful picture.